Hope you're having a great weekend. It's our week in review. A look back at some of the most compelling stories, conversations that we've had throughout the week. Hope you enjoy.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi.
It's always interesting to hear the words of those involved in the cases that we are following for you. We, of course, talk about summaries of everything, and that's great in case you just want to kind of get up to speed. But sometimes if you have the time to sit there and listen to the details, it paints a much bigger, wider, darker picture of what it is we are talking about. We're about to go into some of the audio. This is the full audio, actually, of the judge severing the cases between Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. We have it for you in two parts, the state going first on their arguments, and then, of course, hearing the defense and what the judge orders. Let's go to that audio. It was done via, I believe, a Skype conference. Here's the first part.
All right, good morning. We're on the record on cases CR 22-211623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell, and cases 22-211624, State versus Lori Noreen Vallow Daybell. Before we get started here, I want to confirm our remote appearances. We have Mr. Pryor. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Daybell, can you hear me as well? All right. Confirm then, we're doing this hearing in person today as a in-person court hearing. However, I've allowed for the appearance by Zoom of both the defendant, Mr. Daybell, and his counsel based on the shortened time frame of the notice for this hearing, which is continued over from a hearing we had on Monday of this week. Present here in the courtroom, Mrs. Vallow Daybell with counsel, Mr. Archibald, Mr. Wood, and Ms. Blake are here on behalf of the state. This morning, this is a hearing, and I'll also just advise that we do have our ongoing courtroom conduct order that's in effect in this case. Pursuant to the terms of that order, any recording of any audio or visual images of this hearing is strictly prohibited. Please make sure that your phones are either silenced or off. If any phone goes off or disrupts the proceedings, it may be subject to being taken by the bailiff in the case.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I see 9 attendees on Zoom and only 3 cameras. So maybe we can identify who else is attending via Zoom.
Okay. On Zoom, what I'm seeing is a courtroom 2 camera. There's one window for me, Mr. Pryor, Mr. Daybell, the clerk, your co-counsel, John Thomas, I believe, is listening in. And maybe you're not able to see the names I am. The trial court administrator, Tammy White, is also appearing. We've got a window for staff attorney. Is that you? Okay. My staff attorney has her computer on that, and then Rocky Wixom is also apparently listening in on this hearing for the state as one of the prosecutors appearing. So those are the attendees that are here on the Zoom proceedings this morning. And I do authorize specifically each one of those attendees to be present remotely for the hearing, but of course admonishing anyone that is appearing that you're not allowed to in any way record or disseminate any broadcast that you may have through your devices of this hearing, because it's an open hearing, but it's not subject to any kind of redistribution of the Zoom signal. All right, this is a hearing that has been continued from earlier Monday this week to today after the court received word that an additional DNA report of evidence was received during that emergency hearing we had Monday. It was a second report. We were advised of that during a hearing we were in on Monday, February 27th, and that was during a closed sealed portion of the hearing where we were talking specifically about the DNA evidence. At this time, the court, or at that time, the court elected to continue the hearing to today so that we would have time to allow counsel to review the new report and also to offer any argument in furtherance of pending motions to compel the motion to sever filed by Mr. Daybell and the motion to dismiss filed by Mr. Daybell's counsel in this case. We heard all of those on February 23rd. However, with the subsequent information that's been received, the court would like to again reopen for any additional argument to make. And as it relates to those pending motions, I do want to hear argument from defense counsel as well as from the state. I intend to make some rulings on some of these pending motions this morning after arguments are completed. So at this time, the court, in reviewing the file, it also appears there was an additional discovery disclosure that was filed by the state on February 27th. I don't know if any of that goes into any argument that would be scheduled for today, but that's the other development that's occurred since our hearing on Monday. At this time, then, what I'd like to do is reopen for any argument subsequent to our last hearing on your pending motions. Mr. Pryor, I'll start with you. You had the three pending motions, a motion to compel that was filed February 7th, the motion to sever filed February 13th, and your motion to dismiss filed February 10th. Based on any new disclosures, do you have any additional argument to make in support of any of those motions at this time? You're on mute, Mr. Pryor.
Again, Judge, I'm sorry. Yes, if I may, Judge.
Go ahead.
Judge, the motion to compel is I think, is resolved. I got a correspondence from the prosecuting attorney's office yesterday saying that the 12 terabytes of evidence has now been downloaded to the hard drive that I provided to them. That I can come and pick that up at any time. And I responded that I would do that. Obviously, I'm in Boise today, and I'm not at liberty to go down there today and pick that up, but I anticipate picking that up shortly. So as far as that's concerned, they provided the 12 terabytes of evidence. So as far as I'm concerned, the motion to compel in regards to that is resolved. Reviewing those 12 terabytes of evidence is a different story, and I'm obviously going to need some time to do that. The court is correct that I believe on Monday there was additional disclosure of another supplemental discovery. My office was provided a FedEx note just yesterday. I was out of the office yesterday, but the note was delivered to my office saying that I'm able to go to the FedEx office in Boise and pick up the discovery, which is the 13th supplement. I was provided an addendum. There are a significant number of items on that, including witness interviews and statements by various witnesses. I'm not at liberty at this point to discuss the details of how involved that is. What I do know is that there are additional discovery items, and there are a numerous number of them that are also going to need to be processed and go through. And again, Judge, I anticipate picking that up right after this hearing and having my team start the process of going through that most recent disclosure of even more evidence from the state. I'm sure they can identify what that is, and I would assume Mr. Archibald will respond to that. Judge, I think in regards to my Brady motion to dismiss, I've discussed that in enough detail that the court has an idea of what my argument is. I do want to touch again, Judge, on this motion to sever. My concern is this, Judge, is that the DNA evidence that was disclosed back in late December, obviously there wasn't an opportunity for me to have an independent test done. And Judge, even if I got that evidence in December, I would probably still not have a report ready identifying the manner in which I was going to have my office tested. We agreed to an expert by the prosecuting attorney. They provided that evidence you know, a short time ago. And then lo and behold, Judge, at the hearing last Tuesday, we get another report. Obviously, the significance of that is this, is that evidence provides, at least from my perspective, an explanation potentially of where Mr. Daybell and I are going to go in this particular case. I need to have an opportunity to test that evidence. I need to have an opportunity to conduct actually the STR and the genealogical study of that evidence. Dr. Hampinkian has made it clear through his declaration, which I haven't seen any declaration from any other expert or any response, but he's going to need at least 60 days. And frankly, Judge, the nature of that DNA evidence is going to require even more time. That 60 days is only going to start once I get possession of that evidence and I get all of the technical data that I need to receive from the state. Now, I'm not going to pick on the state today to everybody's surprise, but quite frankly, Judge, receiving that technical data is going to take some time. And the state's going to have to, at least to some extent, cooperate in me getting that data. I can't speak to the level of cooperation they're going to give me. But in any event, I have a right to test brand new DNA evidence. I have a right to test and question this most recent report. And the most recent report, Judge, came in on Tuesday of this week. I have not even had a chance to deal with that with Dr. Hampinkian. We've been unable to communicate at this point regarding that most recent report. But I take some issues. Mr. Thomas spoke of that last week about some of the issues he takes with the representations made by the state's expert. Well, I take issues with representations made by the state's expert in that report as well. And I'm going to need to challenge all of that evidence and it's going to take some time. Mr. Daybell, this isn't just a phone call or an interview with a witness or a document that wasn't provided from the state. We have plenty of that as well. We have a significant amount of evidence. The state is for whatever reason, and it doesn't matter the reason, has provided a lot of evidence very, very, very late in this proceeding. But when you're talking about DNA evidence, that's a whole different item. That is something that takes a significant amount of time and a significant amount of effort to evaluate. And this could have a profound impact on this case. This isn't just an insignificant piece of information. Again, I'm not going to get into specific details, and I agree with the court that that's highly inappropriate. That just fuels all the speculation out there, and we don't need to do that. But, Judge, we are talking about a significant piece of information, a piece of information that would have a profound impact on how this case proceeds and how the defense and the state present this case. I can't overemphasize the significance of what this information means. At that point, Judge, I think it's imperative that the court provide me an opportunity to do that. Now, if Mr. Archibald and Mr. Thomas don't want to do that because Ms. Vallow Daybell does not want to waive her speedy trial, well, that's her choice to do that. I'm not going to speak for Mr. Archibald or Mr. Thomas, but I am going to speak for Mr. Daybell, and he wants this thing set out so that I can have an adequate amount of time to review this and to draw our own conclusions from what this evidence provides. And again, Judge, it's highly significant. And given that, Judge, I can't see any other alternative than to give Mr. Daybell that opportunity to have an independent testing of this information, independent evaluation, independent report. And frankly, Judge, I my gut belief is that we're going to come up with a little bit of a different conclusion than what the state's going to recommend or the state's documents represent. Now, I'm not an expert, but at least on a cursory view of this evidence, it seems to suggest something other than what the state's representing. So at this point, Judge, I'm going to renew my motion to sever and ask the court to please allow us to have an opportunity to conduct that further investigation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pryor. What I'm going to do is allow at this point for defense counsel also for the companion case on Ms. Vallow's case to present any further argument, and then I'll hear response from the state after that. So, Mr. Archibald, would you like to present any further additional arguments subsequent to our hearing last week?
Your Honor, we're disappointed that the state held on to this evidence for so long without notifying the two defendants here of the evidence against them. Disappointed that they thought that they could be the sole judge of what's exculpatory and what's inculpatory. So this evidence has been held by the state for undue periods of time, and that's what finds us here. That's what finds Mr. Pryor asking for more time. If my client waived speedy trial, I would also be asking for more time. But since she has held that right and held it close to her, I have to respect that due to the constitutional autonomy that she has. So I agree that Mr. Pryor has the right to have this DNA evidence independently examined, that there's not enough time for that to be done between now and trial. I agree with Mr. Pryor that this is not the defendant's fault. It's not the defendant's attorney's fault. That the blame for it rests solely upon the state. And so when the government holds evidence and refuses to turn it over, either because they're playing cute or they're playing ignorant, as Mr. Pryor has argued, that the responsibility still is on them. And so similarly to the DNA evidence, this disclosure this week is really disappointing to me as well. That we were here in court Monday. They could have handed me this supplemental discovery disclosure when we were here in court, but no, they filed it after our hearing. I didn't get the flash drive until Tuesday, and I still haven't gone through all of it. It's 10 pages of items, 10 pages that's listing out hundreds of interviews and exhibits that we have not seen yet. So we're getting ready for trial, and now we're supposed to also get ready go through new evidence that's being hand-delivered to us the month before trial, 3 weeks before we're starting to select a jury. It's pretty ridiculous, really. And so I have to file now a motion in limine to exclude all of this evidence that they gave to me 2 days ago. I now have to set another hearing. We now have to annoy the court with more motions to exclude evidence because they've been sitting on it. There's witnesses and interviews here from the FBI in 2020. And I just get it now? I'm just really disappointed. So that'll be a motion that's coming. We'll need to schedule that with the court and counsel. I don't have anything else to say.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Archibald. Who's going to be presenting argument on behalf of the state this morning?
I will be, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Blake, I allowed both counsel there, so in whatever order you think is appropriate, you can address the comments and additional arguments made by both counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I know the court's heard a lot about the discovery in this case, and we've gone over it multiple times, but I would reiterate, and all parties have said this repeatedly, there is a massive amount of discovery and evidence in this case. The bulk of the discovery was turned over at the outset of this case. The bulk of the discovery was actually turned over to defendant's counsel. Now, I recognize Mr. Archibald is newer to the case, but in the prior proceeding, a case that has been dismissed, much of this is the same evidence, and by far the bulk of the evidence was turned over at that time. Because of the massive amount of discovery and evidence in this case, as well as the multiple law enforcement agencies that have been working in this case, The state has gone back through to try to ensure that we did not miss turning anything over. The majority of what has been turned over are items that were located that we did not realize were not turned over. The state cannot turn over what we do not have in our possession. While we understand that discovery in law enforcement's possession is impugned to the prosecutor's office as well, as is very normal with discovery responses, we say as soon as the state has it in our possession, we will get it turned over. That's what's been done here. In addition, when we look at just the Rule 16 of the Idaho criminal rules, much of what the state has turned over would go above and beyond what is actually required. We look at, is the state using some of this evidence in our case in chief? No, we're not. Is it exculpatory? The state does not see it that way. But in an abundance of caution, we are turning over everything. The state is in a position that if we don't turn anything over, they're going to say that it must have been exculpatory or it had some value. If we do turn it over, then we're turning it over late. So the state is kind of in a position where we're trying to do our due diligence and ensure that the defense has absolutely everything the state has absolutely everything the state has access to.
Let me just raise a point or two here, Ms. Blake. First of all, on the argument that they got the bulk of the evidence, these are capital charges. Is the defense not entitled to all of the evidence? If it's relevant enough to be listed in discovery disclosures from the state, I mean, as far as I know, they get all the evidence. They don't get the bulk or the majority of the evidence. Would you agree with that as a general proposition in a capital case?
Yes, Your Honor, and I would agree with that as a proposition in any criminal case.
Okay, and secondly, this latest new disclosure, which, according to Mr. Archibald, is voluminous, the issue I've got there, and we're going to hear this, as he mentioned, in another motion, in another hearing before trial, our court's scheduling order, which was issued last December, gave a deadline for completion of discovery prior to February 27th. So this, although it's a day late, it's late under the scheduling order. All discovery must be completed prior to February 27th, 2023. And the notice of the new filing of the discovery is filed in the case at 4:03 on the 27th. So it's late under the court's scheduling order. Again, I've presided over a lot of cases. I know how things get hectic when we're getting close to trial. This is a capital case. The indication today that there's a voluminous amount of new discovery just being handed over after the scheduling order deadline, I'll tell you, it's extremely concerning for the court, and I see Mr. Archibald's notable frustration here of having this evidence now delivered past the deadline that we had all known about for some time. So I do have concerns on the timing here, and sorry to interject in your argument, but I want to let you know how I'm seeing that issue as it's playing out right now. So if you'd like to continue with your argument, Ms. Blake, you can.
And, Your Honor, I think hearing the court say that it was due before the 27th, I think that may have been the state's interpretation had been that it was due by the 27th. So we had attempted to make arrangements to get discovery out on the Friday before, and it ultimately went out on the 27th with our belief that that's when it was due.
Let me just read what the order says. Discovery, paragraph 2, all discovery must be completed prior to February 27th, 2023. The reason that date is included is because at 9 a.m. on February 23rd, well, we had our pretrial conference scheduled, and the point is having all discovery completed and done at the time of pretrial conference, which we heard on that date. So, again, I don't see where there's a question on what the order requires for a deadline. Could have been misinterpreted or misread or overlooked by the state, just focused on the date there, but it clearly says prior to February 27th. If you'd like to continue with any argument, you may, Ms. Blake.
With regard to the specific items of discovery that have been referenced, and I think we've argued those previously, but the 12 terabytes, that has been previously addressed by the state. As the state has indicated, that particular discovery, the defense was put on notice of that in the last case. They were provided a copy, and as well in this case at the outset, they were provided a copy of what the items were that had been retrieved from the property and that those were available for review. No request has been made until very recently to get a copy of those. Whether that's a strategic or tactical decision or not, those items were made available. So to try to argue that the state is late in disclosing those is simply an error. Those had been disclosed. They were known to be available to defense, and there has been no request until very recently. With regard to the DNA evidence, which seems and appears to be the bulk of the current argument set for today, I know now there's been some additional argument raised, but the court already has a history of that particular evidence that's the issue of the discussion today. But I think given statements by counsel, it may be important to reiterate some of the timeline with that particular evidence. That particular evidence was discovered or was located, in conjunction with some consumptive testing. The reason that's important is we had some evidence that was located at the state lab very early on. In this case, it was actually the point of some discussion, again, in the prior proceedings that preceded the cases in question that are before the court today. Because it was consumptive testing, we needed to wait to get some kind of an agreement or an order from the court. Due to the stay in Ms. Vallow, on Ms. Vallow's side of the case, we were unable to get that consumptive testing order ultimately entered until August of 2022. So before August of this year, the consumptive testing could not take place. Once we received that order in August, the problem was the evidence in question that was going to be tested that was consumptive, the evidence in question that linked to the first consumptive order, I guess, to clarify, was not in the state lab's possession. It had been sent back east to another lab for additional testing. That was done by stipulation of the parties. The parties would have known that it was back there. So the state lab had to wait for that evidence to come back for them to perform the consumptive testing. That didn't come back until approximately November 10th. We received the report from the other lab on approximately October 31st. So on November 10th, when that came back, then the state lab was able to be in possession of it to complete the consumptive testing. It's my understanding the lab tech completed that about November 19th. Excuse me, Your Honor, the evidence was set back pursuant to a warrant for testing to the lab back east, but it was not in the state's possession at that time to complete the consumptive testing. When it was returned on November 10th, the lab then was able to get the testing. The initial consumptive testing was performed approximately November 19th. At that time, the additional evidence that's the subject of the current pending motion was located by the state lab. The particular evidence that we're talking about today was not believed to actually have any evidentiary value by the state lab. However, it had the possibility of being tested, and because of that, they collected that evidence at that time. Again, the problem was they could not proceed with the testing because the testing on that particular evidence would be consumptive. Defense counsel was notified as soon as the state was aware of the discovery of this, or not discovery, but the location of this new evidence. Again, we had to wait to get an agreement for consumptive testing. Once we were able to get the testing was completed in December, we were not able to get that agreement and get an order signed until January 9th. So on January 12th, the state lab received that order for consumptive testing on that newly discovered or newly located evidence. And that testing was completed approximately on July 18th, and then they had to wait for the report to be approved. And once that was approved, we were able to get that and then give a copy to defense counsel. So with that, any argument or representation that the state sat on this evidence or did not disclose the evidence that we were playing games or that we knew of the existence of this evidence is simply not true. We learned of the existence of the evidence just before defense counsel learned of it. With this, again, the lab was not confident that there would be any evidentiary value, and the testing that they were able to do did not produce any DNA profile or any additional usable evidence. Because we were aware of how close we were getting to the trial deadline, the state, although we didn't want any additional testing done on this, we didn't see the value in it given where this evidence was located and how this particular evidence can be transferred about, we didn't see the value in that. However, out of a good faith, we located a lab that could turn around some additional testing on that very quickly. We reached out to defense counsel. We didn't hear back from Ms. Vallow's counsel, but Mr. Daybell's counsel got back to us and said, let's go ahead and have it done. He was in agreement. He knew who the lab was, and he was in agreement with having that move forward. At that time, if Defendant Daybell had wanted to have independent testing done, the state was not set on doing the testing. They could have at that point in late January said, hey, we want the evidence and we want to send it to our own expert. Defense has represented, I think testing would take approximately 6 to 8 weeks. Had he requested it at that time, he could have already had it with his expert and the testing being completed. Instead, he chose to agree to have the expert located by the state complete that testing. As soon as we received those results, and again, we're talking about DNA testing that generally does not have this quick of a turnaround, but we were able to find a lab that was willing to expedite and work with us. And then still, it's that we're turning over late reports. That report was turned over immediately when the state got it last Thursday. An additional report was completed, and we received that last Thursday during the hearing. While the timing may be odd, it was a report explaining the process completed and giving a little more information to the parties as to how that was done. It was determined that potentially there could be some additional testing that would be available. The current lab that looked at this said their process would be about 6 weeks. They could potentially expedite it, but there was no guarantee on that. But if we wanted to reach out, they said we always could to see if they could expedite some additional testing. Again, that lab, similar to the Idaho State Lab, has indicated the chance of finding any actual evidentiary or truly exculpatory evidence would be very unlikely that that could happen.
Well, there's two types of testing that could be done, the STR and the genealogical testing. Isn't it true that one of them may well develop additional information? There's a higher likelihood of the genealogical testing.
That is correct, Your Honor. The STR testing, at least from the state's conversation with the current lab that has it, is the likelihood of that resulting in any profile would be extremely rare, and it would consume the entire sample. Mind you, what the state had done was not consumptive testing either. Those extracts still exist and are available for testing. The genealogical or ancestral could result in some kind of a profile, but that would simply let us know who the person was related to. And based on this particular type of evidence and how it's transferred about in the environments, the likelihood, based on both the lab's assessment and both the state lab and the second lab's assessment, is it would have an extremely low probability of resulting in any kind of truly evidentiary, having any true evidentiary value.
I guess I struggle with that concept based on discussions we had in the closed sealed portion of the record, that it appears to me what's been disclosed here is there is something there. There is DNA evidence. It came directly from the crime scene. It's indicative of unknown persons that could further be identified through additional testing. Is that an accurate assessment of where this evidence is at this point?
Your Honor, the only thing the state would say is I don't know that we can say definitively that the evidence came from the crime scene, given this particular type of evidence and how it's known to be transferred in the environment. I don't know that we could definitively say that. I think the state would agree that there is the potential to come up with some DNA profiles that would link to specific individuals. We would agree with that assessment.
Okay. And that, going back to the timeline you've laid out here, the timeline in order to complete and conclude that testing puts us out at least 6 weeks from today. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. As I indicated, there is the chance they could expedite that process, but there was no guarantee. The doctor we were talking to would have to talk to other lab personnel to check on a timeline with that. But there is the potential for the current lab to expedite that proceeding.
Okay. Thank you for those responses, Ms. Blake.
And, Your Honor, I guess, again, I would bring up, this evidence has been available, and where it was located has been available for review by the defense. And to date, no one has requested to look at that or to review it. We verified with the state lab that the items of evidence where this particular evidence was located have been available for review. They're in evidence there at the state lab. There's been no request to review those. So the state didn't learn of these until late December or in December, which was the same time we notified the defense of these particular items. I think the state had talked before when we're looking at the continuance, we'd cited to several cases, state v. Ochoa being one, 169 Idaho 903. That's an Idaho Supreme Court case that basically reiterates, to qualify for a continuance based on late disclosure, a party must not only show that the late disclosure generally prejudiced the party, but they must also show that a fair trial was denied because there is a reasonable probability that the result of the proceedings would have been different had the additional time been granted. And then also looking to state v. Webster, 123 Idaho 233. That's an Idaho appellate court case from 1993. And essentially, when viewed in relation to the other evidence admitted at trial, there was nothing to support that the undisclosed evidence would have raised a reasonable doubt concerning the guilt, which would have deprived the defendant of a fundamental right to due process. And finally, state v. Caswell, 121 Idaho 801. That's an Idaho Supreme Court case from 1992. That one essentially determines that, even assuming the state's original response was inadequate, we find no abuse of discretion in the trial court's conclusion that Caswell's failure for 5 months to pursue the matter further and request more specific test information or to obtain their own experts precluded them from arguing that there was an inadequacy. And so I think when we look at those, this particular evidence, the defense isn't without a remedy as it sits now, and arguably there could be an argument that they sit in a better position now than they could with additional testing, given the fact that we have some DNA evidence that has an unknown source. The defense can still argue that. Presumably they would argue that that is exculpatory evidence. The state would not agree with that assessment and would not concede that this is exculpatory evidence because we simply don't know at this point.
Isn't the best remedy really to sever here, to allow time for the testing so we don't have to delve into all this speculation about what this evidence is?
And I would argue no, given the fact that case law regarding severance, and I know the state cited to it multiple times, but it's disfavored when the parties are properly joined, and it's disfavored for multiple reasons, including judicial economy, efficiency, and also fairness to the defendants. With a joint trial, we avoid inconsistent verdicts. In addition to the fact we avoid one party gaining an advantage by watching the other party be tried and gain that tactical advantage in relation to the other defendant. So I think when we're looking at the requirements with severance, it's essentially meant to be if there is no other possible remedy available. The state would argue there is one other possible remedy available that the court could consider, and that would be to simply continue the trial as a whole and delay it to start in either May or June. Representation by defense counsel is this additional DNA testing would take 6 to 8 weeks with his expert. And that's if, I haven't heard from the expert if he's deemed the necessity of this or where exactly they will go with this, but the representation is 6 to 8 weeks. Ms. Ballow was arraigned last April. Then there was a motion to stay that resulted in a delay in her case, which was filed on October 6th, and the trial was vacated on October 18th of 2022. if we factor in the delay that was a result of that motion to stay or toll the time and vacate the trial, if we factor that in and the trial were delayed to start into May or even into June, at the beginning of June, we would keep her within the 1 year from her, from the date that she was arraigned. And given the profound cost and time in trying these, the fact that these are conspiracy cases and there is a strong favoring of trying conspiracy cases together, that it would result in the state essentially trying the same case twice, bringing in all the same witnesses. In addition to the fact, I think one additional factor the state can consider is in State v. Risden, 151 Idaho 244, that's an appellate court case from 2012. It reiterates that when the reason for the delay is well defined and the reason on its face clearly does or clearly does not constitute good cause, there is no occasion to consider the other Barker factors in assessing a claimed violation. I think when we look at that, if we keep her start date within 1 year, I think there's clearly good cause to continue it. And the other, if the court...
Mike, on the speedy trial issue, just there's a lot of factors that weigh into those decisions. And one of the things this court has to look at is not just the arraignment date, because she was arrested and incarcerated in what I'll call precursor cases. And she hasn't been in jail for a year. She's been in jail, I think, for over 2.5 years and has never waived speedy trial in this case. But there is a line of cases out there that you don't just consider the dates in the case at bar. You consider overall a person's constitutional right to not have to endure excessive incarceration before trial if they assert that right. And she's been in jail much, much longer than the year you're referring to. And that, I think, has to factor into a decision of whether or not these cases need to be severed. The other point I'll just bring up is, as you well know, because we've been to Ada County multiple times coordinating, it's a large courthouse with a lot going on and a lot of other trials, and they are hosting the trial in this case, and we really don't have the luxury of just telling them when trial is going to be. We have to be able to work with them to coordinate that, and we've done it twice now, first for the trial that was scheduled to start in January, now for the trial in April. And information that I've got in talking to their administrative district judge, I don't believe it's possible for us to start a trial just in May or June. I think that if trial gets continued, they may not be able to do it until much later, possibly towards the end of the year. So that's another concern. If we had the ability to simply pick and choose dates, that's one thing, but there's a lot of factors that come into play. I am fully aware of the cost, the time, the resources being taken into account here, but that's the reality. And when we talk about judicial economy and efficiency, these are policies that this court has to consider also, and we can't simply go in and impose on Ada County the date that we say it's going to be tried there. It has to be coordinated. So those are two huge issues I see in front of me on this decision. Number one, if it were to be continued, a huge concern I have of violating the right to a speedy trial. And secondly, again, the time of delay, I don't know how long that would be. So I do appreciate the argument of that being a potential remedy, but I just want to be upfront with you about how I see that as a practical matter, whether that is something this court can do without violating the constitutional rights of the co-defendant here. So I'm just giving you my perspective of where I see things, and I'll be happy to hear any continued argument, Ms. Blake.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would also look to State v. Campbell, 104 Idaho 705, and that's an appellate court case from 1983. When we look at that case, it was a co-defendant case in which both had had multiple pretrial motions that were filed. One defendant later tried to argue that his speedy trial rights had been impaired by the delay resulting from consideration of the motions filed by his co-defendant. However, what the court ultimately found was Campbell voiced no objection or resistance to the simultaneous consideration of his motion with those filed by the co-defendant. All motions were decided in the same proceeding. In our view, had that situation not been agreeable to Campbell, he should have taken affirmative steps to alter the procedure. It is clear that where delays in bringing a defendant to trial are caused or consented to by the defendant, he is considered to have waived his right to be tried within the time fixed by statute or required by Constitution. The state would argue, I think the court could consider that as well. The position taken by Ms. Vallow's defense counsel today is that while she is asserting her right to speedy trial, they have concerns with this evidence as well. They also believe this evidence should be tested. So I think we have kind of two positions being taken by Ms. Vallow as well and her counsel. So in addition, the state would indicate, and I don't have the case law in front of me, but I know we've argued this previously, when we're looking at a time computation, and this was dealt with in Ms. Vallow's motion to dismiss based on lack of speedy trial, when we look at the actual time computation, time is not computed for prior unrelated charges or prior charges that were not substantially similar. And based on the analysis done there, the charges were not substantially similar to count that time. While the state is cognizant and understands Ms. Vallow has been incarcerated, a large part of that incarceration was due to commitment proceedings during which her case was stayed, and the state had no control over that, and that was a delay attributable to the defendant. The state recognizes that was pre-arraignment, but I think a significant amount of the time spent is with regard to that. I recognize the difficulties with scheduling this with Ada County, but I think if ultimately, given the time, cost, and the other reasons that support joint trials and joint and defendants properly joined remaining together, maybe there would be another remedy available in holding a trial somewhere that could accommodate a May or June trial setting. I think if we were to do that, it would allow Mr. Pryor the testing time. In addition to the fact, if there is good cause to continue Mr. Daybell's case, it seems that that good cause would also apply to Ms. Vallow Daybell's side of things. I think that's all the state has.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi.
There's more on this hearing, and we're going to have it for you right here on the feed. So be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. And that's coming up for you next. Tony Bruschi, stay with us.